If we have a better money that has better properties than exists today, and the financial infrastructure around that is much better, then what businesses could you build in that world that you couldn't build today? That's what excites me about crypto.
Welcome to Bankless, where we are continuing our exploration of the Ethereum roadmap. Today on the show, we are bringing back Mike Noyder, who was just on the show to give his defense of the Ethereum roadmap. And this time we are joined by Blockworks' Mike Ippolito, who brings a wealth of pragmatic knowledge from around the crypto industry to add his thoughts to the conversation around Ethereum's current position. Before we get into the podcast, this is your final warning to get your ticket to Permissionless. This is our third Permissionless, and this is going to be a banger. Just look at the speaker lineup. We've got politicians like Richie Pokemon Card Torres, Gary Gensler's bully, Tom Emmer. We've got investors like Van Spencer, Chris Dixon, Haseeb, and Balaji Srinivasan. We've got builders like Sriram, Nick White, Alex Glukowski from ZK Sync. And you guys know my thesis about podcaster-organized conferences. We simply produce the best conversations. That's what we do. So you're going to hear me debate Alex Thorne from Galaxy and Eric Wall about Bitcoin stuff. They think that they've won, but they haven't. Max Resnick and Kyle Samani are going to debate Mahalo from Polygon and Jill from Espresso as to whether or not layer twos are Ethereum. Even Ryan Sean Adams is going to be there in the flesh, opening up the whole entire conference with Chris Dixon from A16Z. And then on the last day, Kane Warwick and I will be on a panel together just a few hours before we go head-to-head in Karate Combat's most high-profile matchup to date. Their words, not mine. So there is a link in the show notes to make sure that you attend all of this good stuff. There is also a party Wednesday for all of the Bankless citizens out there. So if you are not a Bankless citizen and you want to go to Permissionless, there is a link in the show notes to get tickets. And if you are a Bankless citizen and you're going to Permissionless, there is also a link to make sure that you guys have access to our party. So go get them. This episode will flow very nicely if you have been following along our recent podcast episodes around these topics. Most recently with Mike Noyder's episode just last week, but also starting with Kyle Samani's episode, which many in Ethereum foundationally disagreed with, and also Max Resnick's episode, which people also disagreed with, but I think nonetheless at least found some value from, even if maybe the delivery of his points were a little bit overly spicy. As for me, my ideas around Ethereum continue to be in flux. The direction we are going is directionally correct. And whether we want to reprioritize different parts of the Ethereum roadmap in different orders, I think is actually kind of a moot point, since the development teams focused on, for example, the Ethereum Layer 1 execution or the development teams around Ethereum Layer 2 data availability are different teams that are already working on both in parallel. All of these different parts of the Ethereum roadmap are all happening in parallel. So it's more about how the social layer around Ethereum thinks about our priorities as a community, as a culture. So what do? Are we even off track at all? Or is it all just narrative and price? I have more thoughts on that. That'll be in the Bankless newsletter soon. So without further ado, I bring you Mike and Mike. But first, a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible, especially Kraken, our preferred exchange for crypto in 2024. If you do not have an account with Kraken, consider clicking the links in the show notes to getting started with Kraken today. If you want a crypto trading experience backed by world-class security and award-winning support teams, then head over to Kraken, one of the longest-standing and most secure crypto platforms in the world. Kraken is on a journey to build a more accessible, inclusive, and fair financial system, making it simple and secure for everyone, everywhere, to trade crypto. Kraken's intuitive trading tools are designed to grow with you, empowering you to make your first or your 100th trade in just a few clicks. And there's an award-winning client support team available 24/7 to help you along the way, along with a whole range of educational guides, articles, and videos. With products and features like Kraken Pro and Kraken NFT Marketplace and a seamless app to bring it all together, it's really the perfect place to get your complete crypto experience. So check out the simple, secure, and powerful way for everyone to trade crypto, whether you're a complete beginner or a seasoned pro. Go to kraken.com/bankless to see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Launching a token? Don't let complex legal and tax issues slow you down. Toku provides specialized support to optimize your launch and ensure that you as a founder and your team and your investors get the most tax-efficient outcomes. The Toku team understands the crypto space inside and out and will ensure your token launch is fully compliant while maximizing tax efficiency. Toku can connect you with the best attorneys if you need them to make sure that you have the best advice, and Toku can help to optimize your taxes so you pay the least possible amount of taxes while still maintaining legal compliance. With Toku's guidance, you can concentrate on building your company while Toku handles the logistics. Token launches don't have to be complicated. Talk to Toku today to get a free initial token valuation. Have you ever felt that the tools for developing decentralized applications are too restrictive and fail to leverage advancements from traditional software programming? There's a wide range of expressive building blocks beyond conventional smart contracts and Solidity development. Don't waste your time building the basics from scratch, and don't limit the potential of your vision. Cartesi provides powerful and scalable solutions for developers that supercharge app development. With a Cartesi virtual machine, you can run a full Linux OS and access decades of rich code libraries and open source tooling for building in Web3. And with Cartesi's unique rollup framework, you'll get real-world scaling and computation. No more competing for block space. So, if you're a developer looking to push the boundaries of what's possible in Web3, Cartesi is now offering up to $50,000 in grants. Head over to Cartesi's grant application page to apply today. And if you're not a developer, those with staked CTSI can take part in the governance process and vote on whether or not a proposal should be funded. Make sure you're vote ready by staking your CTSI before the votes open. Bankless Nation, we're live from the Bankless Studio. I'm here with Mike and Mike. Hey guys, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good. Well. So how are we going to solve the issue of how do I call you guys when I want to talk to specifically one of you?
You can call him Polyamory Mike.
That's what I've been thinking.
Polyamory. No, we're not making that a thing.
So we have Ethereum Mike. Mike Noider, welcome to the show. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for having us.
You can just call me Mike 1.
And then we have
Mike number 1.
The new perspective, because we just did a podcast. Mike, Ethereum Mike here. Mm-hmm. We just did a podcast with Ryan. It's going to come out earlier this week when this goes out. All about the Ethereum roadmap. Kind of in response to two of the episodes that we did with Max Resnick and Kyle Samani.
That was a very popular one, right? The Kyle one? The Bankless?
Yes. A very extremely popular one that everyone loved. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so we just did a kind of like a Ethereum roadmap in 2024, kind of answering to some of the critiques and like qualms presented by these two episodes. And we just did that episode. So we're bringing Polyamory Mike on the episode today. Oh, I swear that'll be the last time I use that. Just to bring in kind of a new perspective onto the Ethereum roadmap, because Mike flirts with a bunch of different other ecosystems. You love Celestia, you love Solana, you love Cosmos, you love Ethereum. And so I think we can kind of have a very similar conversation that we just had with Mike, Ethereum Mike, with discussing the roadmap, but kind of also just discussing where the roadmap fits into the broader landscape of the crypto ecosystem, because Ethereum is not in a vacuum. The Ethereum-centric roadmap exists inside of the context in which it was born, which is all the other ecosystems as well. How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah,
you can do that?
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Maybe we can start Ethereum Mike with kind of just like speed running through some of the main points of the episode that we just did. You had this article titled My E-Thesis, and it was all about just a particular order of the three resources that compose Ethereum. Maybe you can kind of just run us through that.
Right. Yeah. So the episode was basically structured like the article, which we kind of went through settlement, DA, and execution in that order. And so the high level take here is that first and foremost, Ethereum should be and like should strive to continue being the most neutral, censorship resistant base layer that exists in the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think anyone argues about that reality of today. And I think, you know, keeping that as the core kind of founding principle of all the decisions that are made seems very useful. DA obviously is kind of the thing that most people are talking about lately, because it really ties into this idea of how do rollups play into Ethereum? How do they kind of interact, and what value do they add to the Ethereum ecosystem? And so we talked a little bit about potential network effects of DA, how Ethereum DA could come to kind of be differentiated on different axes than just providing the best security and the best censorship resistance for L2s. You know, some of the different constructions, we got a little maybe too technical in the weeds there. Mm-hmm. And so we can leave that there. But then the third piece that I hope we can talk more about today, which I don't think we covered too much, was execution and kind of what is the end game vision for L1 execution? You know, I think there's kind of really, that's probably where the biggest spread is among opinion in the Ethereum ecosystem. You know, Justin, in his debate with Tolley, basically said L1 execution is dead. Like, we should push all of that to the L2, including app deployment and everything. Max kind of swings in the complete opposite direction, saying like, make DeFi on Ethereum great again.
On Ethereum layer one.
Yeah, on layer one. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's pros and cons to both of those, and we can definitely unpack it. Yeah. But yeah, I think that's kind of high level of what we covered in the episode, and hopefully can start us off here too.
Blockworks Mike. such a much easier name.
Yeah, it's like we should have started with that.
You haven't listened to the episode that we just did with Ethereum Mike and Ryan, but also you did listen to the Kyle Samani episode and the Max Resnick episode. Maybe you can kind of give us your high-level thoughts and reactions as you were listening to those and the conversations that spawned out of them.
Yeah, I think that this I kind of reject the framing, actually, that this conversation tends to take on, which is it ends up getting divided in two camps, which is if you think that execution is the valuable layer that's going to generate a whole bunch of cash flows and that's where value is going to accrue, then you're kind of a Solana guy. And if you're a settlement and DA person and you think that's where a lot of the value is, then you're on the Ethereum camp. And my view is that I'm kind of in the camp where we're all building the same thing here. And I think things, I mean, I think he's right about that. And I think my long-term view on all of these L1s is that they're mostly commodities and that they're going to converge on relatively the same architecture and stack. And I actually, maybe a more contrarian point would be, you know, I kind of listened to, you know, the Ethereum argument looking at the execution layer and saying, hey, all this MEV that you're generating today, the incentives aren't really good because your revenue is tied to a decreased or a not great user experience, which I generally agree with. And I think that MEV is going to end up going to the app layer and then get redirected back to users as well. And I agree with that. And then I think the execution maxi perspective is that, you know, just because everything settles down to one layer doesn't mean that you have to pay a lot to that layer or that value necessarily accrues to that layer. And I actually kind of agree with that as well. I actually have a long-term, pretty neutral view on L1s as assets. I think that they're going to create an enormous amount of value in the next like decade or so, because I actually have kind of a Bitcoiner mentality. I think that the thing that's driving activity and adoption today is a structural problem with credit and fiat based money. And I think that's what's moving all of this capital into mostly L1s, which is, I view them as commodity based monies that have an improvement on the governance around their supply. And I think that a bunch of the L1s are going to do pretty well from that. But then I think that the desirable end state of crypto is, once that capital is migrated, that it gets redirected into applications that actually create value for people. I actually don't really agree with the whole framing of like, this one is better than the other one. I think it's all going to end up being commoditized and it's all going to end up flowing back to the apps and users at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I guess I'd push back on calling it commodity because I guess at least in proof of stake, kind of a core fundamental premise of having a staking token is that that token has value, right? Because there's like the economic security or the security of the settlement assurances of the chain are like fundamentally dependent on the token. Mm. And so like if everything's commodity, that kind of implies they're all substitutable. Like ETH is the same as SOL, is the same as Atom or whatever.
Yeah.
But how do you square that with like, there needs to be some core security like underpinning these applications if they are going to be like as secure as they need to be? Or do you think that's kind of like a meme altogether?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think part of the, like my perspective on polyamory in crypto for a while has been, I think that basically there's a very complicated problem that needs to get solved, which is how to build a blockchain and bootstrap an economy on top of that. And I think the way that it's kind of naturally wound up working is that you have different chains that are focused on different parts of that problem, right? You've got kind of Ethereum, which is maximally focused on how do you be a great settlement layer and be extremely censorship resistant. And then Solana is focused in the current timeframe on execution and how can you pack as many transactions as you can into one shared security layer and pipeline and all of that type of thing. But I think what's going to end up happening is that Solana is going to learn some of the lessons of Ethereum. I think Ethereum, I would be in the camp probably more of like the Max Resnick camp of increasing the gas limit, decreasing the block times on Ethereum. And I would move the base layer to look a little bit more Solana-like. And I do think at the end state, you're going to end up with, you know, five or six L1s that like have some differences and might be more specialized for some use cases than others. But I think you're going to end up with stuff that looks pretty similar at the end of the day.
I think I brought that perspective up to Vitalik and just about the idea like, hey, you know, there is some slack at the Ethereum layer one level. Like we could add some capacity. And his response to that was, I think, drawing from lessons of Ethereum's past when we had this like Ice Age mechanism in the proof of work era, which was this, we actually would just like intentionally freeze the blockchain every 6 months until we shipped proof of stake. And it was a forcing function. It was a human layer forcing function. Say, hey, we're going to set a...
It's like the debt ceiling.
We're going to set a bomb. Yeah, we're going to set a bomb off on the Ethereum layer one blockchain. And if we don't, we have to just manually diffuse it over and over and over again until we ship proof of stake. Mm. And he kind of alluded to a similar phenomenon going on with solving layer two composability.
Yeah.
Whether if we just like add more layer one composability just to like, you know, buy us some time, we're actually just like... easing off on the need to solve layer two composability. And that's actually the hard problem. Mm. And also the problem that mostly only Ethereum, Celestia is also working on this, but Ethereum is really leading the charge here. Mm. And so kind of just like reducing that pressure and like allowing, you know, a longer lifespan for, you know, like emphasis and priority of the layer one is actually reducing what is probably Ethereum's biggest value driver in the near-term future, which is solving layer two composability.
Interesting. So his argument there is investing kind of resources of the community, mm-hmm. focus on the research and kind of all core devs layer on L1 scaling actually is just kind of like missing the plot and right. somehow a misprioritization.
Right.
It's like you're, L2 you're just kicking the can because you need to solve this problem eventually. Right. So why not just confront it right now.
Right. And adding 20%, 30%, maybe even a 2x, 3x to the Ethereum layer one capacity is actually just not meaningful. And also it's fun to talk about like, let's just up the gas fees. Let's just add some capacity to the Ethereum layer one, not thinking about how much political difficulty that's going to push into the Ethereum like core dev calls, which are already like pretty slow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess I like this conceptually. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's totally true that it's kind of the natural progression that people are going to want the most control over the DevEx. Like their chains are going to be super specific to, like, I think this is already kind of trending in this direction. You had a nice conversation with Eugene and Frankie about Atlas, which is their kind of targeted DeFi domain specific L2. Like, mm-hmm. I think that type of thing will be pervasive. But I also see the other side of it, which is like, if you leave things as they are and just focus all energy on scaling the L2s, the interop problem only matters if, or is only like valuable if the L2 ecosystems that attract and like are kind of the top of funnel for users and activity are willing to play ball. And I do definitely agree with Max in a lot of regards when he describes like the incentives of the L2 teams and of kind of like how the market structure actually plays out is super important here, because I think everyone loves the vision of like a united chains of Ethereum. And that's kind of like how I usually the mental model I like for the roll up, but there needs to be like some balance between the kind of like state level power and the federal power.
Right.
But if your market structure evolves into like a duopoly or an oligopoly of like a very small set of L2s that have like outsized market power, then it looks a lot more like a Texas and California cessation than an actual like real kind of united chains of great interop that's like composable and neutral in the way that like could be if there were many, many chains.
So. Yeah. There's like one outcome that doesn't feel good to me, which is like Ethereum created DeFi. The Ethereum layer one created DeFi, like started with MakerDAO, Uniswap, Aave, Compound, and then DeFi kind of spawned off of that. And now we have these like states that are like, you know, states, but they're like, oh, there's equity in these things, like the OP tokens, the ARB tokens. Yeah. These are all startups with VC investors and teams. And if there was like, and a large amount of the reason why DeFi came to Ethereum was A, because it invented smart contracts, and B, it was credibly neutral. And so it was the breeding ground for DeFi. And the idea of, I take Stephen Goldfeder's point that DeFi is fundamentally better on a fast, cheap blockchain. Lower fees makes more efficient markets. It's more accessible, more participants, more possible total liquidity. But then also, if that means that like DeFi is only going to exist at the layer two level, then it's like not as credibly neutral. If there's like one dominant DeFi chain, and it used to be the Ethereum layer one, and then it moved on to like one single layer two, because finance and DeFi collectively is going to be better in one single spot. And we can have this united chains of Ethereum where like all of these chains are completely seamless with each other, but that's not even like a medium term goal. That's more of a like a long term goal.
What do you guys see as the market structure for L2s like into the future? It's kind of an interesting spot, right? There are these incumbents that's like the Optimisms and the Arbitrums of the world. Yep. And then there are new upstarts that have these different axes that they're choosing to compete on. There's like Mega ETH, which is you know, crank that shit up to 11, make it go really fast.
Yeah.
And then there's Atlas, which is we're specializing and we're going to be kind of this DeFi very specific chain. And they've got these cool optimizations that make it better for DeFi apps. But where do you guys see that all shaking out?
Yeah, I guess on the kind of axis of the incumbents, I see it being very power law distributed. Like there can only be one, maybe two general purpose rollups.
Agreed.
Like even the OP stack is, it's not totally clear to me like why Optimism and Base aren't like directly competitive. Like I get they do this revenue share thing, but it's like you're fighting for the same apps, the same developers, the same users.
You mean the Optimism mainnet and Base mainnet?
Yeah, exactly.
I actually really like Victor Bunin's point that he gave me, which was what is the one single point of the Optimism mainnet? And his answer to that is the ERC-20 contract for the OP token. In fact, it's very much an Ethereum Foundation growth by subtraction mentality, which is let's take all of the transactions going on Optimism mainnet, make them into their own chain, part of the super chain, and then the OP mainnet does this one thing, which is has the OP token contract, and it governs over the super chain.
I see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But again, this feels a bit isolationist, doesn't it? Like if you belong to this OP chain, then you have your OP legal tender and like everyone, like, yeah, I don't know. And it's also not totally clear how valuable this governance actually is. You know, I think especially if one chain like Base has like 90% of users, like sure, the OP stack can vote whatever they want in, but like once there's enough power, market power for one individual, like they're really setting the rules here.
Right. What would the United States look like if California was 90% of the GDP of the United States?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There'd be challenges.
It's a
bundle. I mean, that business model is a bundle. I do think that even some of the roll-up teams, I wonder if they're starting to rethink a little bit this stack model. And most of the rollups started with like OP main chain, and then they've got the stack, and there's going to be the super chain and all these different chains inside of it. Same thing with Arbitrum One and like ZK Sync Era, et cetera. And I kind of wonder if some of these chains privately are starting to think maybe we should actually get some activity back on like our chain, this stack, right? Because otherwise, to your point, right? If you're the United States and you're the federal government and you've got California and it's 90% of your GDP and population, how much, you know, control or say do you really have? But do you think it would be this is actually something that I love that Ethereum does, which is they're very free market mentality, which is the design philosophy is be max unopinionated at the base layer and then just let people duke it out on the like L2 layer. I don't know. I kind of think that this is how it should work, actually. And actually, in Solana land, it's a little bit more, you know, integrated. You know, you could say it's a little bit more centrally coordinated or planned. Right. And there are definitely drawbacks, I think, to the total free market approach. But, you know, we've kind of slogged through the worst of it, and it looks like the field is thinning, and we're going to wind up with a couple of like really strong, highly competitive incumbents. And then they can make that, you know, interoperability within their own stacks. And then maybe they can do, there'll be some kind of shared sequencer with like an ag layer type thing for interop in between frameworks.
Yeah. I guess this kind of circles back to your original question, which is like, what is the end game market structure of L2s? Yeah. And you know, a big part of your conversation with Stephen from Optimism was
from like, Arbitrum.
Or sorry, from Arbitrum.
He won't like that.
We'll fix that in post.
I might leave that one in there actually.
But a big part of that discussion was like, are L2s symbiotic,
right,
or are L2s parasitic,
right?
And I actually think those two kind of biological terms are really the essence here,
right?
Which is like, sure, it's easy to do the lip service of saying like, yeah, L2s are great because they have Ethereum security and Ethereum censorship resistance and XYZ. But like, that's also very great from the perspective of someone who's trying to like accumulate all the users and cash flow and like value at their chain, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually wanted to push back against the idea of like Ethereum is TCP/IP in the network. In, you know, the internet stack.
This is Steven's take from Arbitrum.
Right.
Ethereum is just this TCP/IP layer. It's like, it's just this protocol runs in the background. It's invisible.
Yeah. Which I think would be great for Arbitrum, but I think would be quite bad for Ethereum because basically TCP/IP is just this set of dumb pipes. There's like no value accrual. It's governed mostly by this group, the ITF, who's like mostly appointed by the biggest like app chains. So like, I think in the traditional internet sense, like all the value accrued at the application layer at,
right,
you know, Facebook, Google, Netflix, et cetera. And so like, sure, Ethereum could just be like these neutral pipes that facilitate the kind of back end of money moving around, but the relative importance of Ethereum in that world is like very small compared to a more like equally distributed outcome.
I think this has also kind of been where Ethereum has like directionally been heading over the last 2 years, at least in people's public perception of it, is this thinning layer one in that has the same like EF mentality. Again, Ayamayaguchi's subtraction mentality. Yep. Like, you know, the EF wants to grow by getting smaller, right? Spin things out, like push complexity to the margins, capture nothing in the center because it wants to decentralize. And you're seeing a lot of that same kind of mentality show up in the Ethereum layer one, which is like, let's push users and execution to the layer twos, and let's reduce complexity at the layer one, push complexity to the margins. And what you're seeing is like kind of a very similar thing. I remember a Sunny Agarwald Epicenter podcast forever ago where he was talking about like this Cosmos vision, and he called Bitcoin an app chain, which it is. Yep. And it does this one job of spits out BTC.
Yeah.
And his vision was that it spits out BTC into the Cosmos app chain mesh layer. And it was just the money for that layer. And that's how Bitcoin fits into it. Thought it was a pretty interesting take. And now you're actually kind of seeing that where you have this Ethereum coordinating protocol that just spits out ETH. And the ETH goes up to the layer twos, but for the rest of Ethereum, it's actually like pretty thin. It's pretty like constrained because all the complexity got pushed up to the layer twos. And I think that's kind of aligned with the vibe of the last 2 years of Ethereum. All the users going to layer twos, all the assets going to layer twos.
Yep.
And then people looking at like the falling fee metrics of the Ethereum layer one and the falling more stable user metrics of the Ethereum layer one. And that's where we're kind of seeing that like growth by subtraction.
Mm. Yeah. I think here's one additional thing I would just say about this whole RL2's parasitic conversation is it presupposes the idea that Ethereum has some kind of choice, right? Or that Solana has a choice.
Mm. Yeah.
These are permissionless networks. You can build whatever you want. This was also something that Sunny Agarwal said that stuck with me. He said, you know, app chains, a permissionless app chain is a little bit of an oxymoron because you, by definition, you can build whatever you want. So how can you keep it to being one application? And so I don't know. I kind of think that I think there is something to the idea that, yes, we unbundled all the different functions of a blockchain from, you know, there's DA, consensus, execution, settlement, and you've unbundled those into different layers. And then you do have different cash flows that are associated with each of those layers. I do think that most of the cash flows are going to come from execution for the time being. But again, I think there's a lot of evidence that that's not what moves the price of an L1. I just don't believe that. And you can look at Bitcoin, which has basically been down only for a number of years. And it's because going back to this, the way that I view the world right now is that I view the mega trend, the structural driver of inflows, is actually a problem with credit-based fiat currency. So I think it's coming in regardless. And then I think in the long run that eventually it will end up being about cash flows. But it's really tough for me to paint a vision of that world far out where any L1 or L2 is able to really retain those. It's very difficult. Like I think it should go ultimately to the apps. And you're already starting to see very forward-thinking teams like the Sorellas of the world that are already figuring out ways to do that. And I think it's mostly an engineering problem, actually, in terms of how to redirect that value.
Yeah, I agree with that overall. But I do think there is an argument about just like what the ecosystem prioritizes.
Yeah, right? I agree.
And in the medium term, like there is a decision that Ethereum, the community right now is like very set on one path. And like that should be viewed as a decision, which is we're going to go all in on DA scaling. And, you know, obviously it's not like one unified theme as evidenced by like the fact that after 4844, there's been a lot of different EIPs floated around. Right. The Electra hard fork has like very little cohesion and consensus around like what the network is actually doing. So I think that's kind of a reflection of the state of the discourse. But yeah, I mean, if Ethereum were to kind of make a more concerted effort to scale the L1, then I do think that would have path dependency in terms of like what the outcome is for like where the users end up settling and end up interacting with the chain.
There is some element of path dependence, I think, as well. I mean, which side, where do you sit on the whole scale the L1 or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm still kind of coming to terms with both. I mean, one part of this discussion that I continue to find kind of intriguing, but slightly unclear is, I guess, the ZK EVM opcode endgame here.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's something Justin talks about a lot, Vitalik talks about a lot, and they're both just like on a different plane than me in terms of understanding that. So I think I want to do a better job kind of understanding it for myself and maybe trying to communicate it out. But if there is a world where truly execution is no longer the bottleneck because you have basically these off-chain proof generation engines mm-hmm. that do all of the execution and to verify the proof is kind of very, very easy from the kind of everyday node perspective, then I could see kind of trying to go towards that endgame by scaling Ethereum L1 kind of in the medium term,
right.
Which is like, yeah, I think even Vitalik has been open to the idea of raising the gas limit to 40 million. Like it hasn't changed in whatever, however many years. There is like Moore's law. There's right. The law about bandwidth increasing. I forget.
What, yeah.
Anyway.
some other dude names law.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I guess if we have super high conviction that this ZK EVM opcode and what Justin terms based or native rollups is kind of the right way to scale L1 execution, then I think there could be an argument to be made that we should try and kind of steer hard in that direction rather than like kind of the direction we're going. I do think it would be intellectually dishonest to say that wouldn't be slight rerouting of, right. of the roadmap and stuff. But it's also like the roadmap as a whole is so big that I don't think you can properly say we're going in all those directions at once with equal priority. So mm-hmm. like you do have to like place your chips somewhere and like right. maybe that's where we should place the chips. But right. again, this is something I want to understand better and maybe mm-hmm. we need Justin here to help explain yeah. it.
I'm curious what you guys think, because the direction that Max is sort of pushing people in, it feels like a pretty big departure, I would say, from the direction of the roadmap pre-Max. I'm kind of reminded of this. I think that guy Emmanuel has shared this around. It's Naval Ravikant, like groups don't disagree or something like that. They create schisms. And in, you know, when you're a part of a group and a community, it's very difficult to disagree and discuss things in unemotional ways. And that's why it ends up like you get these schisms. And he actually used the example of the Protestant and Catholic Church.
Yeah, I was about to say Martin
Luther. Yeah, right. Martin Luther. Yeah, yeah. The one of the OG schisms. And you got it in the Bitcoin camp as well, right. around the block size wars. And I don't know, it feels, I think one of the, I'd be curious to get your guys' perspectives on this, but it feels a little bit like, you know, if you were to pull 100 Bitcoiners and ask, what is the value proposition of Bitcoin? You'd get, you know, 99 or 100 people would say store value, digital yep. gold.
21 million promise.
Yep. And even on the Solana side, I think if you, you know, pulled 100 Solanans, maybe 85 of them would say a single shared state, global yep. NASDAQ.
NASDAQ right. on chain.
NASDAQ yep. on chain. And I think for Ethereum right now, it feels like we're in a little bit of a, you might get different answers if you pulled those 100 people. So mm-hmm. do you think that's an accurate statement? And if so, do you think there needs to be like, hey, we need to hard commit to one direction or another? Or what do you right. guys think?
I definitely agree with that. But I think that's also been always been the case with Ethereum, is yeah. that the Ethereum has always, if you pulled Ethereans about anything, like mostly
but like pre-merge, like,
oh yeah. Yeah. The proof of stake was a North Star for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
But I think once you start like picking off the most obvious North Stars one by one, then all of a sudden like, okay, then we get like a little bit of directionlessness about what we want. But also Ethereum has always had a values of pluralism. Like we want to be a big tent. We want to incorporate as many ideas and philosophies and have room for all of these things inside of the Ethereum ecosystem. And so like to me, having a plurality in thought is not like, that's kind of like interests me about Ethereum. And like right now, like Peter Sigligazi from Geth just was tweeted out his like 15th yeah. take about ETH isn't money.
Right.
And we have like core devs that says ETH is monkey. And then you have the Ethereum community is like, you guys, what the hell are you guys talking about? Like ETH is collateral. It's used as in commerce. Like it's used as gas. Like of course it's money. And the plurality of Ethereum has always been the thing that attracts to me about it. And that's why we have a plurality of layer twos. And I think maybe this schism that's forming in the Ethereum land, which is like, I put out that tweet post, like talking to Max Resnick, which is like, I'm in favor of scaling the Ethereum layer one. And that got like, they had a good amount of engagement from the Ethereum community, which is interesting.
On the negative side.
On the positive side.
Oh, interesting.
On the positive side. Yeah. Sam Kasmanian was like, I totally agree. Yeah. Eric Connor.
All the builders.
It's like, it wasn't even clear, like, where the schism was. Like, you have, like, hardcore OG ETH people like Eric Connor, who's like, yeah, I totally agree. Let's pump the gas.
Yeah.
You have Sam Kasmanian, who's building a layer two, who's like, I totally agree. Let's put DeFi back on the layer one. And then you have, like, Anthony Sassano and, like, Preston from Offchain Labs, who's like, this is, like, why are we distracting ourselves from, like, the very obvious goal of having the Ethereum rollup-centric roadmap? Like, that's a distraction. We all know that we can't put finance all on one chain. Why do that in the first place? And I think to answer your question, Mike, about like Blockworks, Mike, about like the priorities, about like, what do we want to try and like make the layer one more like Solana, or do we want to just focus more on the rollup centric roadmap? To me, that's in the Ethereum land, that is a concave kind of value judgment. Like, it's not going to be convex. Like, we're not going to go full Solana at the Ethereum layer one.
Yeah.
But also going full rollup centric roadmap and being Celestia and having no execution or settlement at the layer one is also not what we want. And so right now, the schism is actually kind of happening pretty narrowly between a narrow, like, oh, let's take the late game priority of the Ethereum layer one, which was execution, and maybe we bump that up a few layers of priority, but we're still going to have the same outcome at the end of the day, which is like, eventually all chains will have commodity like execution properties, and all chains will have a plurality of layer twos. So like, the schism is happening on priorities, not on direction.
I think it's fundamentally a trade-off, right? And what makes other ecosystems so easy to comprehend is how far along the trade-off curve they are.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just like, yeah, if you can just say NASDAQ on chain or say 21 million promise, then the kind of the communication element of that story is much cleaner versus like the kind of truth, which is obviously more nuanced and
Yeah. I would say I completely agree. I actually view it as a mark of maturity of any, like, when Bitcoin, this was kind of a mark of maturity for them. It was like a hurdle rate that you have to pass this, like, hey, are we going this way or that way? And I think, honestly, Solana is benefiting a little bit from being more in its infancy in a younger chain here. And, you know, I can imagine a world where, okay, they've shipped Fire Dancer and, okay, we've maxed out transaction throughput as much as we can, but now L2s are happening anyway. So like, wait a second, what are we here? You know, I can totally see that happening. I do think, though, that it's important to just align around the one thing I would, you know, it's, I think plurality is definitely good, but like, one mission statement that everyone lines up behind, I think, is also important.
Yeah. I was talking to Ryan about this morning, where he was like, man, Bitcoiners are just way better at us Ethereans at memeing money. They're just really good at it. Yeah. But my response to that was like, they also had no choice. Like, that was the only option that they had. The reason why 99 out of 100 Bitcoiners will say BTC is money is because, like, what the hell else is it?
Yeah.
Like, that's funneled. And Solana doesn't have that in the same degree that Bitcoin has, but it's like 95% of Solana is like, oh yeah, you eat the complexity and you juice up the chain. And that's what we are. And Ethereum, we are doing most things. We're kind of a little bit in all different directions. And so Ethereum has the most choices, which is why you don't have the same like dogma of thought.
Well, think about how many people Bitcoin pushed out.
Right.
You know, like, they pushed a lot of people out.
New projects are coming online to the Mantle Layer 2 every single week. Why is this happening? Maybe it's because Mantle has been on the frontier of Layer 2 design architecture since it first started building Mantle DA, powered by technology from EigenDA. Maybe it's because users are coming onto the Mantle Layer 2 to capture some of the highest yields available in DeFi and to automatically receive the points and tokens being accrued by the $3 billion Mantle treasury in the Mantle reward station. Maybe it's because the Mantle team is one of the most helpful teams to build with, giving you grants, liquidity support, and venture partners to help bootstrap your Mantle application. Maybe it's all of these reasons all put together. So if you're a dev and you want to build on one of the best foundations in crypto, or you're a user looking to claim some ownership on Mantle's DeFi apps, click the link in the show notes to getting started with Mantle. The Uniswap wallet is officially the preferred wallet of Bankless, and it's the one we use anytime when we want to transact on-chain. Whether you're on your browser or on the go, Uniswap wallet makes it easier than ever to swap anytime, anywhere. Use your wallet to transfer funds directly from a top centralized exchange and tap in thousands of tokens across Ethereum and over 10 other chains like Base, Arbitrum, and Optimism. Uniswap Wallet delivers deep liquidity, fast execution, and reliable quotes with zero gas swaps through Uniswap X. And when it comes to security, you can rest easy knowing it's backed by Uniswap Labs, one of the most trusted teams in DeFi. Their code is open source and independently reviewed, so you know it's protected. So why wait? Download the Uniswap Wallet today on Chrome, iOS, and Android. And don't forget to claim your free uni.eth username directly in the mobile wallet. Start swapping smarter with Uniswap. The Arbitrum Portal is your one-stop hub to entering the Ethereum ecosystem. With over 800 apps, Arbitrum offers something for everyone. Dive into the epicenter of DeFi, where advanced trading, lending, and staking platforms are redefining how we interact with money. Explore Arbitrum's rapidly growing gaming hub, from immersed role-playing games, fast-paced fantasy MMOs, to casual luck battle mobile games. Move assets effortlessly between chains and access the ecosystem with ease via Arbitrum's expansive network of bridges and on-ramps. Step into Arbitrum's flourishing NFT and creator space, where artists, collectors, and social converge, and support your favorite streamers all on-chain. Find new and trending apps and learn how to earn rewards across the Arbitrum ecosystem with limited-time campaigns from your favorite projects. Empower your future with Arbitrum. Visit portal.arbitrum.io to find out what's next on your Web3 journey.
What do you guys think about? I'd be curious to get your guys' standpoint on value accrual.
The big question.
How do you guys
see that? Makes our bags go up.
Well, we were chatting a little bit about this, and there's a timeline element to this, which is when should an L1 think about value accrual, and then what is it ultimately going to be? What is ultimately the mechanism going to be? Is it cash flows? Is it monetary premium? Is it network effects of kind of liquidity for the token? I'd be curious what you guys think.
Yeah, I think so. We definitely talked about this a bit on our previous episode, but I guess I still really like the triple point thesis framing, which you outlined like a long time ago. But yeah. I do feel first and foremost that like the big fish is being money, is having that monetary premium. And I think that's fundamentally what ETH is like trying to do. Mm-hmm. And especially in terms of like money that doesn't just sit as a pet rock under your bed, but money that you can use in like a vibrant
money,
economy. And that kind of, you know, that crosses a bit of the line between like just a money asset into like this kind of consumable asset or even capital asset. Like you can maybe get some yield in DeFi. You can, you know, make a stable coin, a decentralized stable coin out of it. But I still think first and foremost, like it's trying to be money and that's where it should be. I do think the kind of cash flow element is important. Like, I definitely don't think, I think there's two things that get conflated here a lot. One is this idea that ETH needs to be net deflationary. And the second being that ETH needs to generate real cash flows. Mm. And I think people usually think, oh, unless ETH is net deflationary, it's not generating enough cash flows for me to like care about the cash flows. But I think that's actually like a bit of a clumping of two things into one. Like, I do think ETH doesn't need to be net deflationary in the long run. And I don't know if there's like a compelling reason to expect it to be, because net deflationary in the long run doesn't make sense, right? Like you take it to the limit and it goes to zero. But that aside, I do think there should be some story about why, like, it's almost like the baseline interest rate of holding ETH should be non-zero. And this is kind of like the internet bond analogy that, that you guys have used before. And, you know, I ran some of the back of the napkin calculations, and if you have 128 blobs per block, which is kind of the maxed out DA that Ethereum hopes to get to with dank sharding, and if you kind of scale up the L2s and they consume all those blobs and pay enough gas to like, you know, post all that data on chain, then even just from the DA itself, in order to like max out or to match the level of issuance that Ethereum does per year, you need like subset, you know, one tenth of a cent transaction fees on the L2s. So there is this idea of like, you can generate real cash flows and still have like insanely cheap transactions on the L2. And this is kind of the like induced demand, like build all the highways, everyone drives all the cars, and you only have to charge a tiny toll to make like a massive amount of money.
Which inherently requires a very optimistic view about crypto at large, because
for sure,
that requires so many transactions.
Right. But
that's like taking the world's commerce and putting it on a bunch of different chains.
For sure. For sure. But I will add one point here, which is this is only to be kind of maintain the total supply of ETH given just DA fees.
Right.
Like I still do subscribe to the belief, and Donkrad was the first person who posted this on the Reddit AMA, and it really resonated with me, which is ETH L1 will benefit from being a neutral kind of bridge between all of these ecosystems. And, you know, I do think there's market power within each individual ecosystem, but being like the Constantinople of the on-chain economy will be valuable just because there's like port fees, you know, bridging. There's always going to be some amount of like tax that gets paid through the DA. And so even if L1 execution doesn't scale to NASDAQ on-chain levels, but it still scales enough that high value transactions, like almost like the B2B price insensitive transactions still choose to use Ethereum as their execution layer, then that in conjunction with like high amounts of fees, crazy retail activity on the L2s posting blobs down is compelling, at least to me. But obviously this circles back to the point of like, is DA actually sticky? Does it have any network effects that lock in the L2s? Because if the L2s see billions of dollars being generated, and then they're just going to look and say like, what am I actually getting from Ethereum here? Like this, is this security actually something my users care about? Right. Like, will I lose users if I just start posting to Google Cloud? Like probably not. So. Right.
I think the moneyness of ETH does a lot better in a paradigm where a lot of layer twos balance each other out and check each other.
100%.
Rather than a dominant or duopoly of layer twos. A duopoly of layer twos is much less moneyness around ETH.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, I have played with this one kind of random thought, and we were talking about it a little before, but I really like this concept of ETH as legal tender. And, you know, I'm kind of in my macro arc, so like bear with me here. But the overall idea here is like one of the core, and Charlie actually had a really fascinating tweet about this, which he posted a poll and he said, which is better for Ethereum? Two choices. First choice, you have a side chain that posts its blobs to Celestia.
Right.
However, it uses ETH as the gas token. Mm-hmm. That's option one. Option two, you have an ETH rollup, meaning they post to Ethereum blobs. They're, you know, they have the smart contract. Everyone's happy, go lucky. However, they use a local, a different gas token. Mm-hmm. And the results were interesting. 50% said it's better to be a side chain that uses ETH as money. 23% said it's better to be an ETH rollup that posts to DA. And 25% or whatever basically didn't respond.
So it's perceived by Twitter that the non-Ethereum, not a rollup, a independent chain that uses ETH as the gas fee is actually better for Ether than the like formally rollup secured by Ethereum DA that doesn't use ETH as the gas token.
And the reason I call this ETH as legal tender is because it's like if you want to belong to this United States of Ethereum or United Chains of Ethereum, then you have to pay gas in ETH. And one really interesting thing you could do here, which is extremely hard to enforce, but you know, there's a big Twitter debate over priority fees and base fees on the L2s. Mm-hmm. And in particular, looking at how base sequencer collected revenue. So L2s use the same transaction fee mechanism as L1, which is 1559. You have a base fee and then you have a priority fee. It's not first come, first serve. There is a kind of batch posting mechanism here. And the way the sequencer orders those transactions when it collects a batch is based on priority fee, right? So everyone pays that base fee and then it effectively turns into a first price auction on ordering, which is exactly what original Ethereum MEV started as, which is just a priority gas auction. And it turns out that if you actually look at the data, 80 to 90% of the fees that L2 transactions pay go to that priority fee, not to the base fee. Mm-hmm. And right now that base fee is just going straight into the treasury. And same with the priority fee. And so actually, I think this is kind of customizable based on your OP stack chain. But I think for base specifically, both of those go to Coinbase itself. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly you get into this really weird thing where, you know, all of that revenue is getting completely extracted by one entity. So one way you could kind of try and socially encourage ETH as legal tender and improve the moneyness of ETH is say, hey, you have to take those fees and you have to burn them, right? Like instead of the base fee in Ethereum L1, you have to burn the base fee as part of 1559. In this version, you just point the base fee to a contract that's controlled by the treasury. Like, no, don't point it to the treasury. Like you're not going to pay it out to future airdroppers, whatever, like destroy it. That's like true neutrality and like true commitment to Ether, the asset. Obviously, like this is a super opinionated thing. And
but yeah, why would they do that? You're just asking them to destroy their revenue, right?
it's going to be a little bit of a tough sell.
I mean, yeah, again, this is like coercive, but you know, social pressure. But
you know, when 1559 was getting designed, actually one of the things that they were concerned about and why they settled on the burn mechanism was, you know, any out of channel, like out of band payment that would get, you know, in between someone who's trying to submit a transaction and a miner at the time, that could be paid in dollars, not necessarily ETH. And there was a term they were calling economic abstraction, which is like, they were concerned back then about losing ETH as currency, like the default currency in the network, actually, which is kind of interesting.
That was actually a lot more of external concern trolling by Bitcoiners, I think.
It might have been. There's an
real reason why to burn the Ether was always credible neutrality. And then, like, kicking out this concern trolling of Bitcoiners of economic abstraction was just like a nice cherry on top that we would have.
Yeah.
But it was always about the neutrality of like, we need to do something with this. Let's do the most credibly neutral thing and burn it.
Right.
Which is good. Yeah. I think in that Twitter poll from Charlie, I would be in the first camp, the side chain that uses ETH as gas.
Is better or worse?
Is better. Although I would say the nuance that I would add to that is that ETH would have a brand issue there, because if you have a bunch of chains and the security assumptions are different, people could lose their ETH. Is like, it could be a brand challenge for Ethereum, but I'd still be in that first camp. Yeah, for me, this is where I start to think about RWAs and stablecoins, et cetera. Like I think that's what it comes down to for me on the roll-up centric roadmap, is if we can somehow find a way to make ETH the native currency on these chains, I think that is much more valuable than the cash flows that you're surrendering. But I don't know how to do that. I mean, that's, I think, the challenge. So do you think that these users on, you know, Optimism and Arbitrum and Base, do you think they're going to prefer Ethereum, or do you think they're going to prefer USDC? And I could actually see it going either way, because one of the most bullish things, I think, in all of Rollupdom is if you just look at the bridges right now, like the amount of ETH that flows into Arbitrum every single day, it's like this incredible vacuum. And I think they might just end up, the liquidity network effects up there just going to outweigh even the preference to hold USDC or something like that.
In the fullness of time, I kind of think all gas payments can and will be completed in any currency. This is, I feel like there's just so many ways that this, I think, ends up as being like the local convergence. Because there's so many different ways to abstract it at the layer two level.
Yeah.
So the only control that Ethereum has is that when a layer two settles and pays for DA and settles, say, the Ethereum layer one, is that's when they are compelled to buy and then use ETH having some sort of reservation demand. But anything that happens on the higher level, it would be against Ethereum's ethos to like compel currency usage. It would also be a stunt on growth, because any chain that was like, well, we have to use Ethereum as our gas token, like, well, maybe we'll go settle on Celestia, because they aren't making those same sort of like forces.
This is the challenge. Choices. So here's a weird catch 22, or this is the way that I view it when it comes to value accrual for the L1, is the catch 22 is, it's very tempting to say, you know, just, you know, don't try to lock in anyone. Don't worry about that. Just, you know, serve the developers that are your customers today and trust that you're going to create value. But there's this funny thing, I think, when it comes to blockchains, which is the total addressable market of those developers that are building on your layer is the amount of market cap of your token. That's why it's so attractive, in my view, to build on Ethereum today. That's why you have SVM L2s that are settling to ETH instead of Solana, because Solana's got $80 billion worth of TAM, or capital on that platform. ETH has $300 billion.
Right.
And so that's the weird catch-22 of this, where you don't want to be overly greedy, and rake too much out of the value that you know, you're creating in your ecosystem. But if you do none of that, the challenge is that your token won't do anything, and then people won't want to build on you because your value prop is now lower.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But there is the fundamental thing, and I think it's kind of what David was hinting at, which is you can desire something to be true, but it's a permissionless system, and if there's a market value for something else existing, it's going to exist, And I think another example of this happening, which was really kind of funny and silly, but very related, which is restaking, Originally, and I didn't really understand this at the time, and I was kind of confused by it. And we had our interview with Sriram back in Christmas time last year, but he was all in on using ETH as the unit of account for restaking. And this was a money argument, right? Like, this is fundamentally...
It's always been a money argument.
It always has been. And that was totally lost on me. And I remember asking him, like, well, you know, these ETH derivatives, especially like staked ETH, wrapped staked ETH, or I guess wrapped staked ETH is a bad example, but anything that's like a liquid staking token, it's not really restaking in that regard, because the person who's deploying capital, isn't actually the one who's staking in the first place. Right. And so I was kind of just like confused by that. And I was like, oh, why don't you just use USDC? And his answer was, you know, it's about the unit of account. It's about kind of spreading ETH as the denomination of economic security. And, you know, everyone was like, oh, this is sick, like very pro Ethereum. And then Symbiotic spins up, and what's their first branding thing, right?
Right.
Any token. Any boom. Token.
Yeah.
It's like,
but also, Sriram and Eigenlayer have always been on the roadmap of, and eventually you will use any token.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just start, and we just, Genesis is with ETH.
Yeah. It's just a funny thing of like, sure, you can try and like push the values top down or whatever, like grassroots, even like kind of our ethos generally seems to be grassroots.
Right.
But if there's a market demand for something, like it's going to come up. And yeah, and to your point, as far as L2's abstracting that away, I do think it's just going to be less and less people even know what they're touching in terms of the chain behind it. So like if I onboard on Base, like the average American is going to know US dollars. And at the point of sale, maybe it converts to ETH and swaps, blah, blah, blah. But it's just not going to be something they pay attention to and think about. And I think that's where ETH loses its... because you can't be money without people being aware that it exists. You know what I mean? And I think that's a very important distinction there.
The last wallet onboarding experience I had was with Clave Wallet on ZK Sync. And I onboarded and downloaded the wallet, face ID, no private keys. It was great. And then got my Clave ID, which is like an ENS version of Clave on ZK Sync.
Yep.
And then I like did like three or four transactions with zero gas in my wallet because Clave paid for my gas.
Yeah.
And they actually probably used ETH in the back end because ZK Sync uses ETH.
Yeah.
But like I was not even exposed. So like not only am I not exposed to gas, I'm not, or the currency to pay for gas. I'm not even exposed to gas at all.
Period.
And honestly, that's going to be the actual convergence of where this goes. Like, it's actually not going to be like chains competing on which currency would you like to use to pay for gas? It's like, actually, well, no, we're just going to solve your gas problem in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's like, we have to go there as an industry. Gas has to go away. Transaction fees has to go away. And then at that point, it's actually more of a Ethereum layer one B2B to it's a layer two. So that's two Bs. And then layer two B2B to its user front ends, which are like paying the gas fees to the layer two.
Right.
And so that's actually really the concept. So it's actually not really about user preferences. It's now about app preferences to layer two preferences to layer one preferences.
Yeah. Yeah. Super interesting. I mean, it's a great point because I use the main 4337 wallet that I've interacted with is Dymo, which is kind of like a peer-to-peer payment app. Disclosure, I am an angel investor in Dymo. And yeah, it's totally a great point. Like when I onboard someone, I just send them $5 and they never hold ETH in that wallet.
Yeah, right.
Like it's a wallet on Base. It has USDC in it, but the gas is getting paid by someone else in ETH, completely abstracted from the user. So yeah. That definitely feels like the right end game in terms of like how user experiences are going to
evolve. Do you think so this is where there's, I think, another element of path dependence. And I'm generally of the perspective that Cosmos was right from the beginning.
Cosmos end game was right. Not the pregame.
Yes.
The pregame, they flopped so hard.
No, but they tried to skim to the end. They tried to skip to the end. Cosmos has been on this forever. Don't require people can pay in whatever they want. But the thing is, the user flow of most people getting into crypto is, hey, I've got a buddy who like tells me I should buy some ETH or Bitcoin and then I buy it and then it goes up and then it's like, oh, what else can I do with this? And then you go from your home base of ETH into, you know, whatever stupid meme coins or whatever else you want to lose money on, you know, it's your casino on Mars. Yeah. But that was the user flow. And then it created this common shelling point, and then it created this huge pool of crypto native capital. And that's when that attracted all the people that wanted to build around it. So I don't know. I still feel like that's not broken, actually. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's going to be different. It could be different with Base this time. Base has crushed it with their, I think they're going to do a really good job this cycle in getting new people because they've got a bunch of people on the exchange and then they've got the smart wallet.
The distribution,
and then they can just move people directly into Base and it's super easy.
Yeah.
But that would, that would make me kind of think differently about a lot of stuff.
One interesting point that kind of ties into this is kind of when we're talking about the asset and its monetary properties.
Yeah.
On the L1, I think one of the unique differentiators of the L1 is that it is the ledger of record for ETH,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think this is a point that also gets lost on people, but when you bridge, you know, your ETH to a smart contract and then out, there is like counterparty risk now. Mm-hmm. And you kind of lose some of the censorship resistance properties, at least until the rollups like scale to stage two and have like really good forced inclusion mechanisms. So yeah, I guess the cypherpunk in me is like, I wonder if there's a world where there's a few black swan events, like big asset seizures or kind of like large scale global censorship that like results in the value of censorship being priced in more meaningfully. And especially like holding the most kind of like trust minimized store of value is becoming increasingly important.
Mm-hmm. This is a similar conversation I was having with Ryan this morning, actually, which is like Ethereum people once upon a time will just like laugh at the Bitcoiners because like, man, you guys are doomers. Like you guys are hoping that doom happens so that your bags can go up. That's an inherently pessimistic version of the world. In Ethereum land, we're so much more optimistic. We like growth. We want to grow economy, things on the economy.
Like, you're like global seizures, baby.
but now in contrast to like the archetypes of the younger generation of crypto cohorts that find Solana this attractive, shiny new toy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Solana is like way more optimistic on Ethereum because like, come on, like is Solana going to hold up against nation state attacks? Like they don't even talk about this in their ethos.
Yeah.
And it also doesn't matter because no nation state is attacking Solana.
Yep.
So it's even more just like kind of trusting of the world that it exists in. It's less priorities on censorship resistance. It's more less DeFi, more open finance, which is
it's fintech.
It's fintech. It's more fintechy, and it's working just fine.
Yeah.
Nothing's going after it. And so now in that contrast, Ethereum is like, oh, but like when the nation states come, y'all are fucked though.
Yeah.
And it's an inherently by contrast, like more doomer vision of the world because Ethereum has prioritized so much on just like censorship resistance, multi-client architecture, credible neutrality, World War III level attack.
Yeah.
And, you know, if World War III never comes, then maybe all of that effort was wasted.
I think I have maybe a somewhat heretical opinion here to share, which is I don't think that any blockchain is nation state resistant.
Even Bitcoin?
Even Bitcoin.
Oh, definitely not Bitcoin.
I don't know.
Actually, no. I would actually rank Ethereum higher than Bitcoin here. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you guys just saw this Hezbollah attack where they exploded the pagers and then turned out they hadn't tampered with the pagers. They just made them.
Yeah.
It's actually so insane.
And I'm just kind of thinking to myself, I don't think any of these things like would really withstand. But what I do think the end game is for crypto networks is you kind of see parallels of it with like the Swifts of the world. There is some precedent in the financial system for credible neutrality. Like there are these shared bits of infrastructure that aren't fully owned by any one country. Swift is an example, although it's heavily leaned on by the United States. It basically is.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that you could do, like one goal for crypto could be, is to say, hey, we're going to become big enough that there's enough financial activity that's happening here and there's enough apps and people are a bit like that it would be like shutting ourselves off from this instead of actually, trying to actually lock it down and prevent it. I don't know. I kind of think the way to winning this thing is winning hearts and minds, maybe I'd be in the heretical camp of like, I don't think designing for World War III actually makes a lot of sense because I think that nation states could blow this stuff up if they wanted to.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure I totally agree with you.
Mm.
Obviously, like it's very hard to speculate on something like this, especially around like the networking layer.
Yeah.
But I do think there's an interesting point to be made here, which is like if you look at the kind of early protocols of the internet, like you have BitTorrent, which is like the censorship resistant, you know, impossible to shut down. And like they tried to shut it down, right?
Yeah,
it's just like the information wants to be free. And I still feel like the value wants to be free is going to be there.
Yeah.
But so this is kind of like the pro side. The con side is like, how much value is BitTorrent actually adding to the world? Like, is it that pro-social? Like, sure. If Netflix and Spotify and the main distribution channels of content started raking people in a way that like they had to go back to like a free distribution channel, then sure, it kind of like serves as a check and balance on that power. But still like 99.99999% of content is consumed on centralized platforms from like the main clearinghouse. So
the worst thing to happen to BitTorrent was Spotify. Yeah, like I was a big torrenter way back in the day.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was kind of clunky. Like you would get low quality files. You would get files with voiceovers in it that weren't a part of it, that were just an ad.
Yep.
And then Spotify came, and for $10 a month, you can get all the music, and it's like a nice curated platform. And to your point, like actually maybe the reason why Spotify is only $10 a month instead of $40 a month or $400 a month is because BitTorrent exists.
Yeah.
Like the alternative is a check.
Right. There is a counterfactual.
But the counterfactual makes no value.
Right.
Like it doesn't actually capture anything. It just exists.
Yeah. How do you price the social value of having an alternative?
Right.
I mean, I still do think this has all been like very bearish. I don't know. I still do believe that value kind of a monetary system and of a digital property manifestation rather than just pure data will be stronger in terms of like preserving individual rights.
Mm-hmm.
And like, obviously the copyright rules are basically what suffered here. It's like you didn't have any digital property. And so the seeding and kind of distribution channels just get very spread.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think for value and money, like these, it's not comparing apples and apples. So I think it's worth kind of at least pointing that out.
I think there's a super bullish story to tell here, which is, I mean, again, this is just the way that I look at the world. But if you look at everything from the lens of what we're reinventing or creating a better version of here is money and a financial system, that is massive, right? That's not like a small thing. And if you view the driver of that as, hey, the debt and the issues with the way that money works today is actually going to push more and more people into this system, then there's a really close linkage in between the money that sits at the center of a financial system and the financial infrastructure that's built around it, right? The issuer of US dollars is the US government and the central bank, right? But then you've got these network of commercial banks that sprung up around it, and they're the ones that actually control the money supply. They custody all of the money. They're basically, it's very, very closely interlinked, linked and related. And we have actually done something a little bit weird in crypto, which is because there's an issue with that money, we created the money first, right? Mm. And we're just like, hey, we've got this commodity money that's really has these really great properties. And we're in the beginning stages of building financial infrastructure around it. That's why all the apps that have really taken off have something to do with, hey, I want to do something with my money. It's Uniswap. I want to trade my money. Or Aave, hey, I want to get a loan against my money, right? That's why we're in the beginning stages of that. And if we have a better money that has better properties than exists today, and the financial infrastructure around that is much better, then if we have, I guess one way to look at like a bright future for this new economy is what could you do in an economy if you had better money and 100 times better financial system? What businesses could you build in that world that you couldn't build today? And that's the part where, you know, you can't really talk about it on a podcast because a lot of that hasn't been built yet, but that is the vision that that's what excites me about crypto.
Thanks for bringing us back there, Mike.
Yeah, I got you. We need a little bit of bull energy there.
No, but I mean, this is fundamentally the foundational argument I tried to make in the ethicist too, which is like fundamentally, like this is a technology, but it's also like a coordination engine. And money is fundamentally, like you guys have said for a long time, it's like a subjective thing. It's intersubjective. It's a shared collective story. Mm-hmm. And I think Ethereum is telling a very credible story for why it should be money in a way that, like, you know, is super valuable. I think it's extremely pro-social and I still believe in it.
One thing that I think is missing from this like money story with in Ethereum, like this conversation in the last few months and in the with like the Max Kyle episodes and then the rebuttal to these episodes is all about like layer ones and value capture and the moneyness around this thing. But what's been missing is like, honestly, like DeFi hasn't had like a renaissance in a really long time.
Yeah.
And a lot of monetary properties come out of DeFi. Like MakerDAO, like was the first ETH is money application, followed by like the you know Uniswap, Aave, Compound, like Frax, all these newer ones, and then we built DeFi 1.0. Tried to build DeFi 2.0. Turned out that was a Ponzi.
Yep.
Oops.
And whoopsies.
Happens.
happens to the best of us. And like we're starting to get some like DeFi like apps, like Sorella. Sorella's like making Uniswap LP great again. But like I wouldn't really ever call it the same level of just like 0 to 1 moment that we had with DeFi. And the moneyness conversations kind of stopped with like DeFi 1.0, I would say.
Yeah.
And so that, like, I don't really know how much more juice. Maybe we just like need to get back on track with building DeFi. Maybe like DeFi 1.0 is actually most of it.
Yep.
And there's not that much more. Like, I don't really know if you guys have thoughts here.
I have thoughts. I think the coins need to go up. And once the coins go up, people will come in and they will build cool stuff. And that's how I really think it's going to work.
That's what DeFi 2.0
But here's the cool thing. Just on the track of being bullish, what we haven't had before is a bunch of very abundant, very cheap, high quality block space.
Yeah.
We have never had that before going into a bull market. We were severely constrained last, like seriously, just rewind the clock back to 2020. Like there was Ethereum, which was great. And, but that was really the only network that you wanted to build on. And, you know, we didn't even have 1559. There were all of these challenges. Like we are in such a different place now. And I just think we're going to get a bunch of really cool stuff to surprise us to the upside.
Yeah. Vitalik had a tweet, I think 4 or 5 days ago, that was basically exactly this, which is, you know, he pulled up.
Me and Vitalik were always saying the same stuff.
Two sides of the same.
We're always saying the same thing.
But the tweet was basically like a time series showing, you know, L2 fees.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a clear point. April 2024.
Right.
Proto Dank Sharding goes live and fees just go to zero. And it's been 5 months.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, I get it. Like the price is down, whatever. People are feeling end of summer angst, but like we are at the beginning of an abundant block space era. And I do think Ethereum block space is like super valuable. People are going to build on it. Like it's going to be, a Cambrian explosion, hopefully when like the real, you know, bull market picks up again.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I got a question for you guys.
Sure.
What would you at the end of this, there's a lot of, you know, I feel like in crypto, there are a couple of different groups and they tend to talk past each other or not want to talk about the same thing. There's the money group and that's like the Bitcoiners and Ethereans, which is like, hey, this is all about the money. And then there's the, hey, this is all about the financial infrastructure, which is like the NASDAQ. That's kind of the Solana.
Yeah.
And then there's, hey, we can build all these cool new business models. And that's also a little bit of Ethereum, I think, and also kind of VCs. Like, stop telling me that wishy-washy money stuff. You know, give me businesses with cash flow, et cetera. And I think that people kind of talk past each other. To me, those are all related things. But what would you guys say would make this whole crypto experiment that we're running a success at the end of the day? Like, okay, you know, we're getting bigger. Some of the initial ideology we might have to make compromises on, whatever. If this thing were to really take off, what would, you know, if we're having this conversation 10 years from now, what would you say, hey, this made it a really successful experiment?
Kind of a hard question. I think you could take it in a bunch of different directions. Like digital identity or like self-sovereign identity that is like legitimized by nation states, as in like your identity that's maintained by some crypto platform with some crypto mechanism is like your way to like check into some country going somewhere. Like that is extremely legitimizing. And that starts to like kind of like in the pendulum of power, take power away from nation states and putting it on the internet, which to me is the individual. And so that's always been like why I'm here. It's like, hey, how, what cryptography has always been about, pushing power towards the margins, pushing power towards the individual. And like, is like these money conversations, like why Bitcoin is so valuable, why Ether is so valuable is because now we have this money that's not in nation states. It's owned and operated by these like individually run networks. And so like digital identity is like also very close with that. We've never really cracked that code. But like once you have this like little cryptographic tool called your public key with your private key and you can roam around the internet and be self-sovereign with like whatever like little credentials that you want to have and you can unlock different things. And you can do that also in meat space. Like that's kind of what I'm looking for is just like, and that could go in like 1,000 different directions, right? Like on-chain ticketing, we've never been able to figure out, but like Ticketmaster needs to die. Come on, let's like solve that problem. Like I want to have
that's what gets me up in the morning, baby.
I want to go and like when I go to this concert tomorrow, I want to show my davidhoffman.eth address, which has some sort of just like digital identity associated with it. It has my my ticket that's associated with it, and that ticket is a bare asset, you know, not a Ticketmaster IOU. Like stuff like this is kind of like where my head's at.
Yeah, I would say super similar in spirit, but maybe even simpler in terms of the actual execution, which I view it very much as like self-sovereign money.
Yeah.
Like that's the inalienable right to send, store, transmit, you know, preserve value on chain is kind of fundamentally what it's all been about. And I actually, you know, like you described earlier, I kind of view it as this check on existing powers that be. Like,
yeah,
people currently in these underdeveloped or like underbanked regimes, like, just don't have access to a way to store their capital. And like, this is what tears countries apart, right? Like, people suffer for like under the monetary policy of these regimes. And like, yeah, fundamentally, I think that is kind of what motivates me and what I hope all of this is in service to. And even if, you know, it doesn't become the one asset that rules them all, still serving as like a credible neutral alternative to the existing infrastructure that these countries have, it feels critical.
Yeah. We in crypto people talk about money as being a social construct, but it's also a tech construct. Or like it's a technology. And one of the things that I'm really hopeful for is, you know, money, the way that money has evolved, if you think about money as gold, there were some properties around gold that made it really nice. It was the original proof of work. You had to dig that shit up with your hands. So you weren't really worried about the supply. But it was challenging when the economy globalized and you needed to move it all around the world very quickly and divide it up really easily. And that didn't really work. And that's when you started relying more on intermediated forms of money like bank IOUs. And then it was like, oh, notes. These banks are really trustworthy. So maybe we just make the IOU the same thing as money. And that technology setup just lent itself towards more of a surveillance state, kind of centralized power at the top thing. And the crypto form of money, because it's programmable and you can send it around and you can do more with it, is actually much more conducive overall to just individual liberties and actually property ownership. It's like strong property rights, I think.
It's the self-sovereignty of gold, the technology of the internet.
And the other thing I would say too is, I mean, for the thing that initially got me into it as well, it's just the risk reward and the opportunity and how fast-paced this industry moves. Yeah. Like, there is no industry like this where it just... the narrative has completely changed one year from the other. There's a bunch of new startups that you can go work at. Just the pace of change and, you know, the intellectual challenge of this industry is really high. And I'm really excited to see, it will be a success for me if in 10 years there are businesses built on blockchain rails that could never have existed, you know, not on blockchain rails. That would be successful from my standpoint. That's what I want to see.
Super cool.
Yeah. Kevin Owocki's It's All Coordination and always has been, has always stuck out to me. Whatever these tools are, I think they do allow for better coordination tools that we've ever had before.
They do.
And that's always been just like, I think like my personal like North Star, like all these tools I talked about a second ago, they're all kind of just like tools to help people coordinate better at higher levels. And so internet scale coordination, we've never really seen before because we don't have the tools to get there. But like what happens when humanity's ability to coordinate like gets a 10x software upgrade. Like you can't really imagine
coordination.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't really imagine what we can do next, but that's always been like the power of crypto to me. Shall I wrap it here, guys?
Bullish.
Bullish. And coordination. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a ton of fun.
Yeah. This is great.
Yeah. So we're in New York. I'm trying to do these in real life podcasts on a semi-regular basis. Who do you guys think I should bring on next? Since you guys know who our neighbors are.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, man. Great question.
Probably get Victor Bunin in here at some point.
You should definitely. You should have my friend Nate on.
Yeah.
He's going to come to your party tonight.
Okay.
He's building this super interesting attention economy game sort of thing on WorldCoin. And I think it's going to be absolutely sick. It has this kind of like 24-hour, you know, that, what was the app where you took a picture once
Be
a
real?
Day? Be Real. Yeah. It has that kind of like once a day viral loop thing.
That's cool.
And yeah, I think. Once he ships it, it's gonna take the world by storm. So cool. I think it's gonna be one of those things that we haven't really seen yet, and hopefully it really goes crazy.
Cool.
Let's go.
Cheviano on?
Nah. you should bring him on. Miss you, buddy.
All right, guys. Thanks for coming over to the studio. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, David.
Bank of the Station, you guys know the deal. Crypto is risky.
ETH is risky.
Other chains, more or less risky, maybe more. But we are glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.